wanted to experience the culture of Alaska Native community and were specifically requested to go to Barrow.
An assistant district attorney for the state has been shot and killed in Barrow. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski talks about negotiating a compromise that can make it through Congress.
There was no way we were going to be able to cram this onto their bill. They needed to be part and parcel of this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
An assistant district attorney was shot and killed in Barrow last night. Brian Sullivan was killed sometime before midnight. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says Barrow police requested state troopers and the Alaska Bureau of Investigation to take over the investigation. Troopers arrived in Barrow around 3:15 this afternoon. Deputy Attorney General Rick Svobodny confirms that Sullivan had worked for the state since the spring of 2012. He had been a military attorney for the Army for 10 years previously.
When I interviewed him, actually, for a job, he was interested in moving to a rural community because he had served in the military overseas in the Middle East and you know, enjoyed being in a place with a different culture. And so he wanted to experience the culture of Alaska Native community and was specifically requested to go to Barrow.
North Slope Borough officials say a man was taken into custody. The suspect's name has not been released. Svobodny says he was called at midnight. He says the shooting happened around 11 p.m.
It was after a sporting event at the local school, because I know that one of the police officers saw him there. So the time frame is somewhere around 11.
Svobodny says Sullivan was not shot at the school event, but he would not confirm where the shooting took place. A trooper's statement says he was killed at a private residence. Svobodny says Sullivan was 49 years old. The Senate is expected to pass a major public lands package this week as a rider to the annual defense bill. Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of the key negotiators on this controversial compromise, which has split advocacy groups on the right and left. APRN's Liz Ruskin examines what it took to free these bills from congressional quagmire and reports that Murkowski is planning more of the same when she becomes a committee chairwoman in the new year.
The 500-page package Murkowski helped negotiate has something for everyone. Grazing rights, mining, logging, but also legal protections on 1 million acres of federal land. Many of the 55 bills it draws from are of great interest to a few communities, but lack national standing. In a Congress that passes very little legislation, Murkowski and other negotiators had to assemble an irresistible package, then attach it to legislation that was sure to move. Murkowski says they had hundreds of leftover bills to choose from, some dating back years.
So it was just, let's take all this stuff out that we have in the basket, dump it on the table, and then figure out how we can make a package that has some conservation, that has some development of our public lands so we can work towards job and production, and just making sure that it's good, solid policy.
It was a massive balancing act. It had to protect enough high-value lands without triggering a firestorm of opposition from pro-development forces. And it had to allow substantial development on public lands without angering environmental groups and lawmakers sympathetic to them. With Senate Natural Resources Chairman Mary Landrieu distracted by what proved to be a losing fight for re-election, Murkowski worked on the package with the leaders of the House House Natural Resources Committee.
Finesse. It took finesse.
It includes the priorities of powerful Western lawmakers and other items to please lawmakers in states with very little public land in flux. Democratic Senator Al Franken of Minnesota, for instance, has a provision to transfer government land to a school district in his home state. It's barely more than a single acre, but his constituents have been striving to get it for a decade. Ann Murkowski says the package had to satisfy the leaders of the Armed Services Committees in both houses to gain their support and confidence that the package wouldn't sink the defense bill.
There was no way we were going to be able to cram this onto their bill. They needed to be part and parcel of this.
Some critics grumble it's the result of secretive horse trading. Murkowski, though, says most of the bills had passed the House or Senate before succumbing to congressional inertia. Opponents on the right have focused on the new wilderness designations, complaining of a land grab. Murkowski points out the legislation also removes the threat of wilderness designation from thousands of acres that were under review. Owen Graham, executive director of the Alaska Forest Association, is pleased the bill transfers 70,000 acres of the Tongass National Forest to the Sea Alaska Corporation, mostly for logging. He's not happy the bill also puts 150,000 acres of the Tongass off limits to development. But Graham says that's a ransom he's willing to pay to save Southeast logging jobs. He says Murkowski did the best she could.
And I recognize that there's a lot of people that don't like parts of the bill, but, you know, that's her job, is to try to balance all these things. And you're not going to, with a contentious issue like land in the Tongass, you're not going to please everybody.
When the Senate reconvenes in January, the Republicans will be in charge, and Senator Murkowski will chair the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Bentley Johnson, an advocate for public land at the National Wildlife Federation, says he hopes this bill is a forerunner of the kind of work Murkowski can produce as chairman.
We certainly hope so. We think she's shown that she can be pragmatic, that she can start with those priorities, that there's a lot of agreement on both sides of the aisle.
Other environmental groups condemn the bill, but Johnson calls the compromise a political breakthrough.
In the last couple Congresses, ideology has really taken over and has prevented good public lands and natural resources bills from being passed.
In a polarized Congress, Murkowski is often seen as a moderate, but not when it comes to Alaska resource development. Johnson says if Murkowski pushes hot-button Alaska issues too hard, he predicts she'll alienate colleagues and produce more stalemate.
If she tackles trying to drill an Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, for instance, right off the bat, that's going to really divide people. That's going to bring out the big guns.
Murkowski says she doesn't intend to use her chairmanship as just a soapbox for ideology.
What I want to try to do is build something, and build something that is going to be more than a message, but build something that is going to be passed and signed into law. That's what I'm trying to accomplish here. And I think this is kind of the first glimpse as to how we're going to try to proceed.
The bill easily passed the House last week. In the defense portion, the bill holds military pay increases to a 1% cap, trims the housing allowance, and adds a $3 pharmacy copay. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A bill to remove the Alaska exemption from the Violence Against Women Act cleared the Senate today. Outgoing Alaska Senator Mark Begich brought the bill to the Senate floor.
I further ask the committee report substitute amendment be withdrawn, the Begich substitute amendment, which is in the desk, be agreed to, the bill as amended be read third time and passed, the title amendment with it at the desk be agreed to, and the motion to reconsider be considered, made and laid upon the table with no intervening action or debate.
It cleared with no objections. The Violence Against Women Act of 2013 allowed lower 48 tribes to prosecute non-Indians who commit acts of domestic violence against Indian spouses and partners. But a provision known as Section 910 excluded Alaska tribal courts. Both Begich and Senator Lisa Murkowski have worked to have it removed. Alaska tribal advocates say the Violence Against Women Act could provide them important tools to combat crime. It's unclear whether the repeal repeal of Section 910 can also pass the House this week before Congress adjourns. U.S. Senator-elect Dan Sullivan has chosen Joe Balash as his chief of staff. Balash served in the Parnell administration as Commissioner of Natural Resources after Sullivan resigned last year to run for office. Before that, he served as Sullivan's deputy commissioner. He also worked in the Alaska legislature for 9 years, including a stretch as chief of staff to the Senate president. During the governor's race this fall, Balash published an opinion piece blasting Bill Walker's record on gas line issues, so there was no chance of him staying on once Walker took office. Sullivan also announced that Mike Anderson will be his spokesman in Washington, D.C. Another new hire for the D.C. office is DeLynn Henry, who will be Sullivan's scheduling director. She worked as Senator Ted Stevens' scheduler and assistant for 23 years. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how global warming is changing subsistence practices.
We haven't landed a bullhead whale in 10 or 12 years or so. They still haven't given up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Juneau nonprofit St. Vincent de Paul and partner agency Seattle-based GMD Development have been awarded $9 million in tax credit financing from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The award will allow the agencies to build 41 units of affordable housing in the capital city for low-income seniors. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Thomas Smith is 70 years old and lives in St. Vincent de Paul's transitional housing for people getting out of homelessness. He's excited about the new senior living facility.
Because that means within 2 years, I can move out of this room and move into my own apartment with a kitchen. I'm really a good cook, and I love my kitchen, but I don't have that here. I have to use a communal kitchen across the way.
Smith has Parkinson's disease and other medical conditions that necessitate a wheelchair. He takes 8 daily medications. Between Social Security, senior benefits, and general assistance, Smith makes about $1,100 a month. He can't afford Juneau's housing prices.
The rents are so high, I would have to give up eating in order to move into, an apartment that costs $750 a month. The bills I need to pay for and the medications I have to buy that Medicare will not pay for. It's very difficult to get by from month to month.
Dan Austin is general manager of St. Vincent de Paul. He says Smith would be one of the first people to move into the new facility. Austin says some people spend up to 4 years on the wait list for the organization's current 24-unit senior housing.
The only turnovers here are when somebody goes to the nursing home or somebody passes away.
The percentage of Juneau's population age 65 and older has doubled in the last 10 years. Seniors now make up 10% of the city's overall population. A recent Juneau Senior Housing and Services Market Demand Study found that in the next 2 decades, seniors will make up 20% of the city's population. Austin sees that growth reflected in St. Vincent de Paul's shelter.
Over the last 5 and 10 years, we've seen the percentage of seniors who are homeless looking for some place to live increase exponentially.
The new facility will be a mix of studio, 1-bedroom and 2-bedroom units with commercial space on the ground floor. The retail space will house the St. Vincent de Paul thrift store. The complex will be built on a lot adjacent to the nonprofit's current property near the airport. The target population is low to moderate income seniors. Austin has been working on this project for 10 years and is happy to see it come into fruition. He hopes to break ground late next summer.
Having worked here for 20 years and watching this organization grow from 10 units of homeless apartments for homeless families to an organization that now owns and manages 124 units throughout this town, What that means to me, it's not 124 units, 124 families.
St. Vincent de Paul also plans to renovate two existing housing facilities in Juneau and one in Haines. Once those projects and the senior facility are done, the organization will own and manage about 200 units in the capital city. Norton Gregory says every unit and every house built in Juneau is a step in the right direction. Gregory sits on the Juneau Affordable Housing Commission. He says the 41 units will target a population the commission sees as one of the most vulnerable.
We have a lot more seniors that are aging out of the workforce, and unfortunately they may not be able to afford to live in our community without these subsidized rental units. So to give them more options is definitely going to make an impact on our community.
St. Vincent de Paul's new senior housing facility is expected to be complete by fall of 2016. The project was named the Home Run by a board of directors member who said to Austin,
"We get this, man. We've hit the home run." So that's what it is. That's what it is. For St. Vincent, it's a home run.
Austin says Juneau needs many more home runs. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Hoonah's Icy Strait Point tourist attraction will see more visitors once a new cruise ship dock is built. That's according to officials, who expect it to attract more cruise lines to the town 50 miles west of Juneau. But critics worry the location will not help the rest of the city. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Hoonah Totem, a Native Village corporation, opened Icy Strait Point back in 2004. Its main attraction is a renovated salmon cannery that houses a museum and gift shops. It's a base for bus tours, wildlife watching excursions, and a mile-long zip line. Over the years, tens of thousands of tourists have arrived at the point via cruise ship, but those ships have anchored nearby and brought passengers ashore via small boats called tenders. That will soon change.
Having the dock will make a difference.
Ruth Banasek is Hoonah Totem Corporation's marketing manager. She says the new dock will allow more and different ships to deliver passengers.
For instance, Disney can't tender. The ship that comes to Alaska does not have tender boats on it. So we have talked with Disney about stopping in once we have the dock.
Any commitments yet?
We're in discussions with them and we're just moving forward. They are very interested, so that's exciting to us.
Disney did not immediately respond to a request for confirmation. Banasek says another line that only uses tender boats occasionally may also be interested. Hoonah Totem, the city of Hoonah, and the state recently formed a partnership to oversee the dock's design and construction. But it hasn't always been that friendly. The city of Hoonah for many years wanted another location, closer to town and easier for fishermen and other locals to use. The former mayor and city council members cited a study showing the current site to be too windy in the winter.
Considering the kind of weather they get there, I'm sure it's going to take a hell of a beating.
Bob Prunella is a former Hoonah City Administrator who lives in Wrangell.
That spot that the city picked, it's just more protected because, quite frankly, the ships anchor just in a little deeper water right there anyway.
The cruise industry opposed the city-backed site. Officials said it would only use the one now slated for construction, and the state said it would only pay for a site cruise ships would use. Then, elections changed the balance on the city council. Now, an almost $24 million contract is going to Anchorage-based Turnagain Marine Construction. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Alaska Laborers Local 71 and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities ask you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Alaska Laborers Local 71, working hard for Alaska. This message is sponsored by Alaska Laborers Local 71.
Wild foods are important to Alaskans and especially to rural residents. But as Cambier's Jocelyn Estes reports, subsistence users and scientists say climate change is affecting wildlife populations, access to subsistence resources, and food preservation.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says subsistence hunting and fishing make up a large share of the food supply in rural Alaska, about 375 pounds per person per year, compared to 22 pounds per person in urban areas. Stanley Hawley, tribal administrator for Kivalina in northwest Alaska, says subsistence involves more than putting food on the table.
Once we get exposed to that livelihood, that way of living, it gets ingrained in our spirit and in our soul and in our psyche.
Leroy Adams is the tribal housing coordinator in Kivalina, where one bowhead whale would feed the village for a year.
And that's one good thing about Kivalina, is that the sharing of the food.
According to a health assessment of Kivalina by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, or ANTHC, the ice there in years past was as much as 12 feet thick and provided a stable surface for travel and hunting. But in recent years, the ice has been thinner and sometimes isn't there when the whales are passing by, headed to rich feeding grounds farther north. Adams says it takes more gasoline and it's more dangerous to travel the distance to the whales in small boats.
The migration pattern is about, I'd say about 60 to 90 miles out, although they haven't landed a bowhead whale in 10 or 12 years or so. They still haven't given up.
Mike Williams of the Native Village of Akiak says access to subsistence foods is changing in western Alaska, too. For instance, when the Kuskokwim River froze, then thawed in November, Williams says fishermen were left with no way to empty their fish traps, and his were damaged.
They were so full that they busted open, and it's just not regular, you know, checking every day, and we had to wait until there was a freeze, so it can be safe enough to get to our traps.
William says reports of walrus with empty stomachs at a time of year when they need to be piling on the blubber and salmon runs that don't meet escapement goals for spawning also raise concerns about wildlife populations. He says some years when they do catch fish, wet, warm spring weather interferes with food preservation.
We can't even dry our fish when it's you know, raining all the time and moist, and the fish can't dry when, you know, after we cut them up, and they spoil.
Mike Brubaker, director of the ANTHC Center for Climate Change and Health, is launching a program to give hunters in the Bering Strait region test strips to check for germs, viruses, and parasites that cause disease in humans. He says one of the pathogens they're checking for is the parasite toxoplasmosis, which can cause birth defects and eye and brain damage in vulnerable populations. Brubaker says it once occurred only in land mammals, including domestic cats, but that's changing.
It's in about 10% of caribou that have been sampled. They find toxo. And also in about 50% of harbor seals that have been sampled. So somehow some of these pathogens are moving around the wildlife population, and they're moving into new sectors of wildlife, like from land mammals to sea mammals.
Brubaker says the program will allow hunters to check food safety and provide baseline data on the prevalence of pathogens in wildlife, as well as any changes that may occur as temperatures continue to rise. Brubaker's shop has completed health assessments in 20 northern and northwest Alaska communities. He says the reports document the effects of thawing permafrost, melting sea ice, and changing river and lake conditions on wildlife populations, access to subsistence resources, and food preservation throughout those regions. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Restoration of a World War II bomber salvaged from the Tanana River sandbar will benefit from a similar relic. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, parts needed to restore the plane known as Sandbar Mitchell will come from a B-25 that crashed in Nome more than 70 years ago.
The center section of the Sandbar Mitchell B-25 was transported from Fairbanks to the Brighton, Michigan-based Warbirds of Glory Museum in 2013, the first step of a plan to bring the plane back to life. The project requires a lot of rare parts, so Warbirds of Glory Museum director Patrick Mihalik took notice when he received a tip about another B-25 wreck in Nome.
It was actually a Fairbanks resident who contacted me about this that said, hey, did you know about this being up there? And, you know, you might want to contact them. And then, you know, once again, one phone call led to another. And the next thing we know, we started saying, hey, you know, we're going to be going to Alaska again.
Nome's Aviation Museum is donating what's left of the B-25 to the Sandbar Mitchell Project. Project partner Todd Trainer describes the Nome plane as in very similar condition.
Because someone has taken the tail off of it and some of the outer wing panels. So it's the critical center section. There's actually a little bit more of the structure.
Trainer made a reconnaissance trip to Nome this fall, and he and Mihalik plan to lead a volunteer recovery team there next summer to get an aircraft Mihalik says has an interesting story.
It is a lend-lease B-25, which meant that this B-25 was built down here in North America in Kansas. It actually went from Kansas up to Fairbanks, where it was then turned over to Russia, and then they went from Fairbanks over to Nome. And when it got to Nome, it had an incident, which made them just use it as a part ship. And then after it being parted out, it sat there for many, many, many years.
Even though the Nome B-25 is also missing its nose and tail and much of the wings, Mihalik sees value in it.
Mainly for patterns. There's a lot of good parts on there that are, you know, not damaged or bent that we can, you know, assist with the drawings to be able to make the patterns needed to make the parts for Sandbar Mitchell.
Mihalik and Trainer located Sandbar Mitchell's original glass nose at a lower 48 salvage yard, have a lead on the cockpit, and Mihalik is optimistic about finding the tail and wings.
I believe that the wings are probably still out there somewhere in Alaska up in Fairbanks area. I don't know if someone, you know, took them off to use them to make a lean-to or, you know, roofing for something, but I believe that they're out there somewhere.
A group of volunteers has spent the last year and a half tearing down the Sandbar Mitchell, getting to where the aircraft can be rebuilt.
Everything that we've seen so far that, you know, is exactly what we expected. You know, it's an amazingly good condition for sitting out there for 44 years. And the next step is to take the damaged portion of the bomb bay of the fuselage and start rebuilding that from pretty much the ground up. And once we get the bomb bay finished, which we hope probably mid by next year, let's get the spars back on it and start reassembling the wing.
It's estimated that it will take up to $1 million and a decade of work to get the B-25 back in the air. The Sandbar Mitchell recovery was largely supported with a Kickstarter campaign. Mihalik says they'll try to fund next summer's Nome project the same way. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. Subsistence is important to many rural Alaskans. Please consider applying for a 3-year term on your Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. Councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. Apply by January 23, 2015. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.